The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tobias Matei. I'm the deputy editor of the North American Spine Society Journal, and I have the pleasure of having with me today here Lindsay Oros. She's the director of research at the National Spine Health Foundation. We've seen your research presented and the abstracts presented at several of the national meetings. So I'm very excited to discuss with you today about your study published at the NASJ entitled Opioid Use After Elective Spine Surgery. Do spine surgery patients consume less than prescribed today? Thank you very much for coming, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Would you like to introduce yourself and some of the work that you've been doing at the National Spine Health Foundation? I know you've been doing a lot of basic science and the data collection there, and there are several well-known spine surgeons in the medical board of this foundation. So please go ahead and talk a little bit about yourself and your work there.
Yes, thanks so much for the opportunity. So as you said, I'm the director of research at the National Spine Health Foundation, and that's located in Reston, Virginia. And for listeners who don't know, the National Spine Health Foundation is a patient-centered nonprofit organization dedicated to helping spine patients navigate their treatment journey through patient education, research, and advocacy. And it's a really unique program. It's a really unique platform. And, you know, we really want it to be a one-stop shop for patients where they can come and get quality information. And so our medical and scientific board is made up of, you know, over 50 of some of the top surgeons around the nation, and they provide our patients and our audience members with real content, you know, content that they can't get elsewhere. And so it's like having access to world-class individuals, you know, right in the comfort of your own home. And so it's very unique. And we're really happy to be able to provide this to patients because, as we all know, the spine journey can be very scary. And there's not always great information out there. And so quality information is important. And I'm happy to be a part of that. I myself began my clinical career actually as a spine surgery physician assistant. And I did that for 15 years. And so I have my hands-on experience doing that. Then transitioned to a research career after completing some research training at Harvard Medical School's Global Clinical Scholars and Research Training Program. And that's a unique program that's designed to help clinicians become better researchers. And so I'm now in this position where I can, you know, I know the patients, I know the population and can help them through research. And the foundation is such a great place to do that. And recently, NASS and the foundation have both become members of the Coalition of Spine Health. And, you know, that's kind of this groundbreaking coalition made up of lots of organizations, you know, really to advance groundbreaking treatment options and share research findings. And so we're super excited to partner with NASS on that.
And in the name of the whole spine surgery community, we appreciate your efforts as well as the quality of the data you bring to us. So would you be able to just provide our listeners with the basics of your methodology and a glimpse on the results you reach in this study?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really nice to be able to have this platform because you can kind of talk about what led up to the research question, and you don't really get to talk about that so much in the manuscript. And so, you know, I think it's pretty well known in the spine community and in the surgical community in general that in the 1990s, the Danish colorectal surgeon Henri Calais, you know, really described and sort of began to change the way surgical patients recover. And, you know, at that time, it was sort of termed the fast track of surgery, but over time has become this enhanced surgical recovery program. And through the 90s and into the 2000s, this became, you know, kind of widely adopted among subspecialties of surgery, but spine surgery was sort of one of the slower subsurgical, you know, specialties to adopt it. And really, because, you know, it's well known that some spine surgeries are among the more painful operations to go through and to recover from. And so thinking about changing how that recovery goes, you know, it was a little bit scary at first, but in 2017, I was part of a committee that developed an ESR pathway for spine surgery, and then subsequently took care of the patients as this program was being implemented and saw firsthand the benefits I mean, patients really were not needing the PCA, and they really were ambulating the day of surgery. And, you know, they didn't have that, you know, mental unclarity. You know, they were clearer. They were, you know, leaving the hospital faster. And it was great. And it was so amazing to see that, you know, you could translate, you know, these programs into spine surgery. And so then the research began. And in 2021, we were able to put together some papers really looking at what happened, you know, how did patients recover before this program compared to after? And so we looked at the lumbar degenerative population, and we separately looked at the adult deformity population, and both groups recovered better after the program. They left the hospital faster, they walked faster, they had earlier catheter removals, better postoperative pain scores, and they took less opioids in the hospital. And so the one parameter, though, that we were unable to demonstrate was that once they left the hospital, it looked like the amount of opioids they took was the same. And that didn't make much sense. You know, if they were recovering better and their pain scores were lower and they were taking less in the hospital, why were they using the same opioids once they left? So we got to thinking and realized, you know, really the methodology was flawed. You know, we were looking at prescriptions given, and, you know, that's not the same as pills taken. And so we developed this pill count method, and that kind of was the premise of the surgery. You know, we really wanted to determine if spine surgery patients are receiving more than what they're ultimately taking. And so we hypothesized that we were giving them more than they were taking. And so we would determine that by actually counting the pills to see how many pills that they were taking.
I think it's an interesting methodology. You don't actually address what would be the ideal amount of opioids necessary for each patient. I see the study doesn't involve, for example, measures of pain throughout the first week or second week. But it's very intuitive, at least to analyze that those patients that are taking opioids, you're supposing they need the opioids. And we'll see later in the research that at least in terms of the tissue damage, there was a huge difference between patients that were opioid naive and those who were previously taking opioids. So it may well be the case that those patients that were taking opioids before, they were taking opioids longer, even though maybe their acute pain has already somewhat subsided. But at least you remove from the equation the subjective reporting of pain, and you're analyzing if those patients are taking opioids, you're supposing they need the opioids. And then it's upon us as physicians to understand that if the patients are not even taking the opioids, clearly we're overprescribing. And my impression with that, it's something related to the culture, and especially looking back in my practice when you evaluate older physicians. When I began for practice, I had partners that would prescribe 3-4 months of the Norco 10, Q4 hours, and give those prescriptions 180 pills with 3 refills. And I saw that, and at least for me, as recently graduated at that time, that was completely unbelievable. So I think definitely, especially after the implementation of the ERIS protocol, and we see that probably the patients don't need that amount of opioid, and it's more about us changing the culture. So I do believe that we first need to understand the problem. So how much are we overprescribing? What is the order of magnitude of our overprescription? So I do appreciate this data. One question that I have is that, and I'm curious about that, you chose the 90-day parameter, but your study, I mean, there were 3 types of surgeries, one basically anterior cervical approaches, then lumbar laminectomies, microdiscectomy, simple known fusion procedures, and then lumbar fusions, circumferential fusions up to 4 levels, which is the group that, at least in my practice, I observed that they may require opioids a little bit longer. And you decide to evaluate opioids that were not taken up to 90 days. And my question is, why 90 days? Because at least in my practice, ACDFs, I expect them to come for the first follow-up completely off opioids at 2 weeks. I mean, for lumbar laminectomies, that's about the same. For a 4-level fusion, I may tolerate prescribing opioids up to a month. I don't think I've ever had a patient that 3 months after a 4-level fusion or an L2-2 pelvis, I was still willing to prescribe opioids. So why did you choose 90 days instead of, for example, 30 days or maybe even 45, 60 days?
Well, the 90-day mark was a time point where patients were already checking in. They were already coming in. And so we had decided that we would track through that time period, not that patients were necessarily taking them to that time period. And there are also, there are lots of studies that look at this, for the first 2 weeks, but it doesn't capture people who maybe stopped them, but then restarted them. And so we really wanted to make sure that we were going far enough out to be able to really understand what was utilized, knowing that lots of people would be off them by then.
I understand. And it comes to my mind something that, I mean, some states, they have regulations for opioid prescriptions, and we can discuss about the efficacy of that or if we believe it's something that should be more on us physicians. But I mean, some states have a very rigorous schedule for opioid prescription. I know Massachusetts, they have up to 7 days, which, to be honest, I mean, if you're doing a T10 to pelvis or scoliosis surgery, I believe it's very hard to comply with that type of schedule. So it's probably, it's a very interesting legislative effort, which probably suits most of the surgeries. But when you're talking about complex spine surgery, that's really an underestimation of the degree of nociceptive pain associated with the tissue damage involving this type of surgeries. But I'm just saying that because, I mean, for some providers in some states, it may not even be feasible for them to be legally prescribing opioids in 90 days. Right. One other thing, go ahead.
Well, the other thing that differs, there are the state regulations, but then there are also individual insurance regulations. So the state may say that you can prescribe after surgery two weeks supply, but the insurance company may say, no, we're only going to pay for a 1 week supply. So not only do you have to comply with each state's regulations, but you also have to understand each, what payers, what their parameters are and what you can do within that. It makes it really difficult.
Correct. And we discussed about the subgroups of patients. So talk a little bit about the findings in terms of these three categories. I know you analyze, we already discussed the ACDF or anterior cervical group, which also involve arthroplasty, the lumbar decompression, and then the lumbar fusion group. So talk a little bit about the results in terms of unused opioids in 90 days, both in the opioid naive as well as previously opioid user groups.
Yeah, so looking at the study as a whole, 45% of prescribed opioids were unused up to the 90-day mark. But if we broke it down by surgery subgroup, the anterior cervical group had 45% opioids that were unused, and the lumbar decompression was the highest group at 57%. And then the lumbar fusion group, as expected, was lower. They had 28% of unused opioids. But looking further into, what happened with patients who had been exposed to opioids prior to surgery. And our definition in this study was taking any opioids in the 3 months leading up to surgery was considered opioid exposed versus the unexposed. And so, in our study, 42% of people were taking opioids in the 3 months leading up to surgery. So we had a lot of exposure prior to surgery. And of the exposed, there were only 28% of opioids that were unused, which makes sense. The patients who were taking it before surgery tend to take it after surgery and have less unused, whereas the opioid naive had 58% unused opioids at the end. And so, I think as we're thinking about, how do we potentially modify our prescribing practices and update them, you take into consideration what surgery are they having, the decompressions in this group. And in this study and in lots of studies, the lumbar decompression group takes very little. So you can, identify what surgery subgroup are they in and what, might they take according to that. And then, you add in, have they had any exposure to opioids beforehand? That adds, a little bit of information you can gain. And then, there are all these other things that other studies have shown, like, you take less, the older you are, if you're 80 and above, those so groups don't tend to take many opioids, whereas the younger population tends to. And, diagnoses of depression and anxiety tend to take more opioids. And you can start, piecing in all these little bits of information to really identify, how much do I think this person really needs?
One thing that was very surprising to me, and our listeners may want to refer to the manuscript to figure two, but when I analyze these different categories, when I see the anterior cervical group and we have patients taking up to 800 morphine meal equivalents in 3 months. And then you see the opioid, those who use opioid before, there's a huge difference in that population. And we know anterior cervical surgery, I mean, to be honest, I've done surgeries in the vast majority of patients without even prescribing opioids. I mean, there's no paraspinal muscle disruption in this case. I don't think that this disruption is meaningfully enough for you to need opioids more than 4 or 5 days, which even in a lumbar decompression, I take it depending on the patient's BMI, maybe a bigger incision. But for an ACDF, if a patient is taking opioids more than 7 days, at least in my practice, I have a problem. So when I see this discrepancy here, especially in this group, I have a clear feeling that there are patients. Those opioid naives are probably patients with no previous history of chronic neck pain. They have radiculopathy. They have the surgery. They don't even take even the opioids you prescribe in the first few days. And the other group are those patients who have chronic pain that have been taking opioids for 2 or 3 years, but they still need surgery. They have cervical myelopathy. They're having some knee weakness. And that's the group that I worry the most, because you mentioned several factors you should take in account. In my mind, I take in account the degree of tissue disruption, which should have a direct correlation with pain, and the fact that the patient may have some downregulation of their receptors. So if a patient has been taking opioids, I can understand how they may need a higher dose of opioids and maybe a little bit longer because of that. But at some point, those patients, they are back to their baseline. And then the challenge is to differentiate, for example, in these patients with previous use of opioids, what is their chronic pain and what is the acute pain related to surgery. So when I see that difference, I mean, clearly that patients with previous opioid use, they are taking the opioids you prescribe for acute pain to sustain their treatment of chronic pain. And that's a problem, because at least in my practice, I want to treat the pain related to my surgery. I don't want to take over your previously misguided treatment of chronic pain with opioids that have been going on for 5 or 10 years. So I don't know if you have any other insights in terms of the subgroups, but at least in terms of the anterior cervical group, that was very surprising to me.
Yes, it was 10 times, you know, different between opioid exposed and not exposed. And that went down as you go to the fusions, you know, that was only a 1.5 times greater. But yeah, that was really surprising as well for us.
Anything else you notice in terms of that you like to comment regarding the difference among the groups, the surgical groups you evaluated, was insightful?
You know, I think that the fact that our lumbar fusion group had the circumferential approach, that just happened to be what we got during the time period that we collected data. You know, we aren't able to comment on would that number look different if they just had, you know, one approach, you know, whether just anterior or just posterior, and if that would look different. You know, you would assume that there would be less pain with less surgery, but, you know, you don't know.
That was a little bit surprising to me, because when I mean, if you ask my opinion before reading your study, I would imagine that a very problematic group would be the one undergoing lumbar fusion, especially if you're evaluating the difference between opioid naive and patients who were previously taking opioids. And I would say if you do a 4-level fusion on a patient's own chronic narcotics, that's going to be a huge difference in comparison with the opioid naive. There was not that much the case in your study. I mean, there was definitely a difference, but not 10 times as it was in the ACDF group. So at least to my practice, I take the insight that the patients that I should worry the most in terms of chronic use of opioids for pain that is not anymore related to the acute surgical pain is those patients probably where you did a very simple procedure, a 1-level ACDF, and they were on narcotics before. And if you don't put a hard stop and you try to transition those patients to a pain management group who starts prescribing non-opioid medications, but then on Cymbalta, Lyrica, those are the patients that you may end up being prescribing then opioids for a whole year, and they're still reporting neck pain. And they're still saying, because you did the surgery, yes, I need those medications. And I think that's one of the fears that we as surgeons have.
Yeah, and I think that just brings to light maybe the overestimation of, you know, what we think to be the degree of pain that, that they're having, you know. And I think that for me, the take-home message is really that, you know, the modern elective spine surgery patient is really different from the spine surgery patient of the past. And, you know, part of that is because there are so many minimally invasive surgical options, you know, less tissue dissection, like you said, you know, less pain associated with that, shorter recoveries, you know, so you would expect the a less need for opioids. And then, you know, these ESR programs, you know, they're becoming more widely adopted and they really focus on opioid sparing analgesia and really do a great job with that. And so with that, you would expect less opioids. And then finally, you know, the public, this opioid epidemic was declared in 2017. So the public, the general public is aware. And the majority of patients really are fearful of taking opioids and really have a desire to be off them. And so I think that those things combined really allow prescribers of opioids after spine surgery to say, you know, I can modify my practice. You know, patients are taking less than what I would have traditionally given someone because of all these things. And that's a good thing. And so rather than being fearful of, you know, I need them to have adequate pain control, you know, I'm going to give them what they need to have their pain controlled, rather than just think, they need more for that. You know, you can cut them back and they really don't have greater pain scores. And, you know, other studies have shown this, we didn't look at it in this study, but greater pain scores, you know, there aren't increased visits to the ER and urgent cares for more medicines. And so we really can modify what we're doing.
And you mentioned a very important point, which is the people, the population awareness about the opioid epidemic. And I think that changes a little bit our perspective. I grew up when I was in med school, still within that environment of pain being the fifth vital sign. And we, if a patient is in pain, it's my problem. And as a physician, I have to solve the problem. So, I mean, the worst thing that I had as going through my residency is to think about that I'm going to do a surgery and leave the patient cold turkey, and the patient will say, that doctor was terrible. He did this surgery, he cut my back, and now I'm in pain, and I had a terrible post-operative period. So I think most physicians were in a very defensive way, say, okay, I'm going to do the surgery, but I mean, if anything deserves opioid, is this type of tissue disruption and muscle disruption. So we're giving opioids. But at this point, I think we came to a realization and understanding that, I mean, if we're prescribing opioids at the long term for this patient population, we're hurting them. We're not helping them at the long term. So I think a lot, and I try to implement that in my practice, has to do with patient expectation. If I have a patient that does need a surgery, and let's say the patient has myelopathy and the patient is on high dose chronic narcotics, I usually try to explain to them that, yes, I can do the surgery to help you, but as part of even preparing for the surgery, yes, you have to stop smoking. Yes, we're going to come up with a plan so you can reduce the amount of narcotics you're taking, so at least the week or 2 weeks before surgery, you're taking half of those you were taking before, so that the post-operative pain is better controlled with the opioid medications, and giving them the reasonable expectations that my surgery will improve your motor function or your radiculopathy, but don't expect that my surgery will be the holy grail for treatment of chronic neck pain when you have that. And using that approach, I think patients are much more understandable that if post-operative, you set the line to say at 2 weeks, unfortunately, now I can't prescribe you opioids anymore, but we'll continue helping you. We'll arrange for a pain management physician to see you. I have a very positive reaction in terms of the patients understanding that that's a problem they came up to you with, and they're living with the same problem. And spine surgeons, orthopedic surgeons should have in terms of approaching the issue.
Yeah, the ESR programs really highlight the patient education and really having the patient buy in as being part of the recovery. And so that education piece of letting them know what to expect is so important. And I think, you know, the other thing to mention is that, you know, in this study, really we're trying to get at how do we get as close to the right amount as possible? And so we weren't really trying to figure out, you know, how do we lessen the right amount for someone, but really how do we prescribe the right amount? And you know, to understand what are they taking so I know what to prescribe, because really, you know, part of this opioid epidemic, you know, the very small part that we can contribute to is you know, this amount of surplus. If patients aren't using what we're giving them, then they are left, you know, have a bunch left over. And that surplus is then diverted into, you know, misuse, abuse. And, you know, and that happens, you know, over 50% of the time, you know, the people who receive their opioid prescriptions, you know, they're from legitimate prescriptions for, from a friend and family member most of the time. And so if we can avoid those leftover pills laying around, prescribe the right thing for the, you know, for each patient's kind of an individual thing, you know, then we aren't contributing to this crisis.
Your study provides a very reliable data in terms of increasing the awareness for us as spine surgeons about our pattern of prescriptions of opioids, and to the point that even for those who want to be a little bit more liberal on that, there's nothing wrong in prescribing the patients 1 week or 2 weeks. And then if you want to extend a little bit longer, then you give them longer. But if the patients don't request, then you don't extend. But it's really surprising that in this study, I mean, almost 50% of the prescribed opioids were not taken, and who knows where they ended up. I mean, we know from the national data that the vast majority of patients that ended up with heroin addiction and opioid-related death, they started with taking regularly prescribed opioids from their families. So it's definitely a big problem. And I just want to get your sense in terms of, because this is one point which is raising the awareness of physicians in terms of their pattern of prescription. But I'd like to get your opinion on other measures more at a system level in terms of addressing the opioid epidemic. And we already mentioned about some legislative efforts. Some of them are focused on a fixed timeline for prescriptions of opioids. So, for example, in Massachusetts, we have those 7 days, a 7-day window in which you can prescribe opioid postoperative. And some other states, they limit the opioids in terms of the morphine milli equivalent. And I've seen the threshold of 90 or 120. And at least in my opinion, I'll give my opinion, but I would like to hear your opinion on that too. Both options have some benefits, but also some problems. I believe that limiting to, for example, a fixed time window, it's a little bit naive if you try to address the problem as a whole in terms of medicine. At least spine surgery, we know we're within the group of orthopedic procedures that probably require the highest amount of opioids. So if you want that to be applicable to scoliosis surgery or deformity surgery, I think it's completely unreasonable. But at the same time, I understand that the policies mainly target to physicians who perform appendectomy or simpler surgeries. So I think that's one problem of the fixed time approach. And the problem about the morphine milli equivalence is that I think that's a very good strategy for chronic prescription of opioids. So if you see a patient in our office and they are already beyond the threshold, you know you can go beyond that and you'll be tagged by the state system if you try to go above that level. But at the same time, if I see a patient in my office and the patient has a clear surgical indication and the patient is myelopathic, and unfortunately he's taking 100 morphine milli equivalents a day, above 100 morphine milli equivalents on a monthly basis, I cannot even prescribe him postoperative opioids so he can keep the pattern of 100 morphine milli equivalents. So at some point, I'm not only not increasing his dose, which I'm fine with not increasing that dose to even more dangerous levels, but I cannot even keep that dose. So how am I supposed to keep the patient comfortable postoperative with that ceiling? But I'd like to hear a little bit your input on both approaches and if there's anything else in terms of legislative approaches that we could possibly think about in terms of improving the issue.
Yeah, I struggle with this because, you know, I think that, you know, as a spine, you know, expert, you know, you're the expert on taking care of your patient, and to have these restrictions, you know, it really can hamper what you're doing with your patient. And, you know, I think that we have to trust that we're training, you know, spine surgeons to do the right thing and make the right choice and give what they need and learn and educate themselves about this to make smart choices rather than just, you know, put a bunch of restrictions on them. And I think that if you're in a practice where, you know, you don't want to stay up to date on this and you don't want to, you know, understand what you need to do as far as doing the right thing for patients and, you know, how long should you prescribe for, you know, some of the duration restrictions can kind of take that from you. You know, you could say, well, I'm only allowed to prescribe you this amount, so that's all you're going to get. You'll go back to your pain doctor. And that works for the spine surgeon, but that probably doesn't work for the patient. You know, they just go to someone else and continue to get opioids. And so, you know, where does it stop? You know, the pain management doctors are great at managing opioids, but they don't really have the knowledge of this spine. And so, you know, to kind of see your patient recover and know, you know, how they're recovering from that surgery and when their pain should end, and you kind of miss that. And you just go into a mill where you're prescribing because that's what you do. You're a pain doctor and you prescribe medicines. And so I struggle with these regulations because I think that, you know, if you're the specialist, you know, you should really be a specialized in all aspects. And so maybe there's, you know, special programs where for further education, you know, that you have to maintain in order to, you know, prescribe certain durations or certain amounts or something like that.
I completely agree with you. I do believe that the best strategies in terms of addressing the issues come from inside the spine surgery community. And I appreciate every NASS meeting and every other big meeting you go, there's a very strong educational program on not only limiting the amount of opioids, but even recognizing factors that may influence your decision on how long to extend the opioids. I'm a little afraid sometimes that there may be a generation who goes to the other end of the spectrum, who's afraid of prescribing opioids. And I don't think that should be the case, but definitely we should be fearful of the long-term effects of opioids and getting that fine line between not leaving the patients, especially in the post-operative period, going through acute pain related to the procedure, but at the same time, not contributing to the opioid epidemic and to their long-term problem of pain. And in that sense, your study is very good in terms of giving us an idea that at least right now, the way we're prescribing, we probably can cut in half the amount of opioids we're prescribing, or at least the time frame during which we're prescribing opioids without running any major risk of leaving the patients in pain, because those patients are not even taking those opioids anyway. So we're just reducing the likelihood that those opioids will end up in the street and causing more social problems.
Exactly.
Anything else you would like to mention on the topic or about your research?
No, that was a great summary. I think that's a good take-home message.
Okay, perfect. I appreciate your time with us and congratulations again on your manuscript and the publication. Congratulations on the good work you've been doing at the foundation. And we look forward to having more of your research published at NASS J.
Thank you so much again. This was a pleasure and we love working with NASS.